Okay.
Good morning. My name is Colin Wynn. I'm here this morning with my brothers, Don Wynn and Tony Wynn. It's January 2018, and Tony and I are going to talk with Don this morning. We have a couple of questions for him, and I hope that all the people that listen to this will find it interesting. I know Tony and I certainly do. So good morning, Don. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning.
Tony?
Good morning, fellas.
Well, we'll go ahead and get started. Tony and I had talked about a couple of questions, Don, we wanted to ask you and get you to talk about for us things that we've always thought were interesting about both your personal life and your professional life. So, but we'll start off with one that's always intrigued me, and I watched you guys do this from afar because I was already gone from home at the time. But you guys, Don, you in particular, built a doggone car from the ground up on the driveway of our house, no garage, just the driveway, and the thing actually run. You drove it on the streets. There are people with million-dollar garages that can't do that. Can you tell me how you got interested in such thing and details, you know, like how long it took and what you did, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that's one of the things in my life I'm really proud of, having done that. The first car, I've done two cars. The first one was a 1928 Model A Ford. And I've always been mechanically inclined, just interested in how things work, like gears or anything else, just how things work. It just intrigues me. And before I went to the Army, after I graduated from high school, I met a guy named Ernie Duckett, who had drag race cars. And he told me about this Model A body that was a couple blocks from his house. And I went over there with Robert Broder in a trailer, and I bought the body for $25. And when we got home, I told Ernie what I wanted to do, and he told me he could weld the frame and put all the parts together that would allow me to build it out. And he gave me a list of what each part of that would cost. And I put it in my billfold. And then I go into the basic training in the Army. And in basic training, I thought about that car pretty much every day. Most soldiers think about their girlfriend. But I was thinking about that car. And when I got out of basic training, I came back and I started doing little pieces along. And it took about, I think, about 3 years until we're able to drive the car. But Tony helped me with a lot of it. I painted the car. I put all the parts together. I built the engine from scratch. I'd never even had an engine apart. And I built the engine from scratch, and I was surprised the thing ran. But it did. It was a 265 cubic inch, one of the real early Chevrolet engines. But that's how it got started, I had that car about 5 or 6 years.
You know, Don, I recall stories about you and Tony, especially driving that car around, and I think you had some lady friends inside that thing, I suspect, over the years. But you and Tony made a road trip in that thing, if I recall the story correctly. Didn't you go to a car show, I think, in Tennessee somewhere?
Yeah. We drove it all over Huntsville. One of the first drives that we did was up and down the Montesano Mountain on the old sort of scenic road. That was my favorite drive, I think, ever, was up and down that road in that car. But at one point, we decided, well, we're going to go to Gatlinburg, which is 250 miles, to a car show. Now, this is like a couple of days. It's a long weekend. You go park your car in the parking lot, and people walk by it and stuff and all of that, and you just talk to car people. So Tony and I get together. I remember I had to go to the credit union to get a loan to have enough money to go. That's And it wasn't very much. But we drove up there, and there was maybe 10,000 cars in that car show. And there was, we were part of a club that had maybe 25 cars in it or something. And all those cars were breaking down. We drove as a group. And one after the other, every one of those cars would break down and we'd have to stop and fix it somehow. So we get up to Gatlinburg and we didn't break down. And ours was the rattiest looking car there. But it, I love the car, but it was ratty looking. We got there, and while we were there, the steering wheel broke. The steering wheel broke. It just came right off the end of the steering column. And we figured, how in the world are we going to get this car home? So we had a few tools. So we took a pair of vice grip pliers and we clamped that to the top of the steering column, just the post, as tight as we could make it. And we drove the car home with vice grip pliers as the steering wheel. But, we consider that not to have been broke down because we didn't have to stop along the side of the road. But looking back, it's a crazy thing to do, but that's what we did.
That sounds like fun. I know Tony's mentioned it a couple times over the years that that you guys had a really good time. And I guess one of the pleasures of it all was knowing that you had been successful at that long process of building that car.
Yeah, that one was... Before I was married and, you know, didn't have responsibilities and all that beyond just yourself. And I would have that car today. I wish I still had it. But at one point there was a freeze and I didn't have enough antifreeze in it or something. The engine froze and it ruined the engine. And I didn't have the finances or the, you know, all of it was done outside. And I didn't have the finances of the workplace to work on anymore, so that's what happened to that car. I never drove it again after the engine froze.
I've always been curious what you did with it, Don. Did you just sell it to somebody?
Yeah, I did sell it. I sold the body, but I kept the frame and the steering gear and all the parts that went with it. And I had it for... up until I started a second car when I was about, I wanted to do another street rod after I had family and all of that and kids are grown or nearly grown. And I talked to Ernie Duckett again and he said, let's do one from scratch. And I said, okay, I guess we can do that. And I started a second car. This was a 31 Ford. And at that point, I sold the frame that I still had from the first car to Ernie. But we started another car, and that car has been in process about 20 years. And I've been driving it for about 5 years. But it's a 31 Ford that looks a lot like the first one, except this one has fenders and the first one didn't. But they're very similar cars.
You know, Don, you've shared some of the stories of driving around there in Florida where you live and, you know, and some of the responses and comments that you get out on the road. And but I'm sure that's pleasurable, driving that thing around and waving at people and they want to stop and know who you are and what are you doing and where'd you get that car and that kind of stuff. So I'm sure that's a lot of fun.
It's fun to drive, and it does get attention a lot of times, more attention from kids than from adults, because you know it looks like a toy, and it pretty much is a toy, but I mean it gets attention from kids, and I'm getting high fives and stuff all the time. But there's just a satisfaction in starting something like that and getting it on the road. But it's a unique car, and it does draw a lot of attention, but it's a satisfaction of doing anything on it and getting finished and being able to look at it and say, yeah, I did that.
Yeah, you know, Tony and I were talking earlier, Don, and of course, you know, we're sitting here talking about cars, but that's not really the subject. The cars are just a way to be able to know that something happened and we're actually correct in our opinions. But, Don, I got to say, Tony, I'm sure you might have a comment as well, but, man, if nothing else, man, that shows tenacity. I mean, to build a car reinforcing with somebody's skills and, you know, the stick-with-it attitude that you got. And, of course, you carried that attitude to everything you ever did, I think. Tony, I mean, you know, we talked about that. What do you think, man?
Collins, I'll say this. Don wasn't afraid to do something he'd never done before. He built that first car. It was a metal body. It wasn't a fiberglass kit or anything. He built everything. Frame, gas tank, the bucket seats. I mean, he built everything. And, you know, he'd try something. If it didn't work, he'd try something else, and he made it work. And I'm sure he did that on the second car, too. It was amazing, the things he would do. I was just a laborer. I wasn't the one that did the work or figured anything out. He did all of that. But, I mean, he built it from the ground up, piece by piece by piece. He didn't buy anything. He didn't go out like they do now and buy a frame or anything. He made a frame. He didn't go buy a gas tank. He made a gas tank. He didn't go buy headers. He built headers.
You know, we were talking earlier, and you get some comments already about tenacity and that kind of stuff and stick to it. And you know, and I'll be honest with you, Don, I got some of that, you know, that stuff, the comments you made about dreaming about that car while you're in basic training. I'm sure what that is, and I do this a lot too. You know, if I decide to take on some project, whatever, how large, ever how small the project might be, you know, I think what you're telling me is the same thing I do. It's I'll lay at night for a week beforehand, figuring out how the parts go together and how would I do this and what do I need to do first and think about it. And by the time I get ready to do it, I have already done it and been successful in my mind. And I'm sure probably that's what you were doing.
Yeah, you're right. And even now on the second car, as you know, in my work, I travel all over the place. And when I'm on an airplane or when I'm in a hotel or something, I spend time thinking about what I'm going to do that weekend, the coming weekend. But you said something a minute ago, somebody did, about skill. I wouldn't say I had a lot of skill. And I have more skill now, but I'm not what you would call a craftsman at all. You know, I do some things that are good quality, but the way that I do things on a car is I'm not afraid to fail. I'll try anything. And what I do is if I think, I wonder what this will look like. And then I spend weeks and weeks making it do that. And then when it's sitting there and I'm finished, I look at it and think, I'm not sure I like that, or that didn't work out right. And I will do the entire thing again. You know, or I'll do it a different way, or I'll say, look, that didn't work. I'm going to try something else. And that ability to try, that's, you know, it's not, you know, I start things, I don't know if I'm going to be successful or not. I hope I am. But, and I talk with Dixie about that. I tell her that if she ever needs brain surgery, I'd be willing to try. But you know, it's not about having, you don't have to get the skill before you try something. You know, you don't want to do something crazy, but if you wait till you have the skill, you'll never do anything, because you're always
You got to get started. Yeah.
Yeah. And I do that.
The hardest part about getting finished is getting started, you know? So
that's true.
Hey, Tony, I was going to ask Don, about his, we'll transition a little bit into his professional life, and talk a little bit about, the travel and stuff. Have you got any thoughts on that, Tony?
I have some serious questions. I remember, I'm not sure, but I think his first travel job was to South America during a time that drug wars and things were going on. And I thought when he did it, I thought, that can't be safe. He did it anyway. Well, I mean, you know, going to a basic is not a war, but like we think a war, but it's a war of swords.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, that's a good way to start this, and I would introduce this part of the interview by saying, Don, Tony, and I have been, we're real curious about all that, Don. You know, like I said, you know, you were a regular guy at one time and would go to work in the morning and come home in the afternoon, and at some point, apparently, you had an opportunity to develop that involved travel. And you took the opportunity, apparently, now, I'm guessing. And apparently, either you made so much money you couldn't quit it, or you decided you liked that kind of a lifestyle to live on the road, so to speak. I guess you got 50 million miles, frequent flyer miles. You said been in a hotel over 5,000 nights or something like that. So can you tell us a little bit about that, Don, and how you got started and that kind of thing?
Yeah, in my career, really, I guess in my life, I can't say I ever really planned anything. You know, things just kind of happened, and I was prepared when some lucky event took place. You know, that's really what it amounted to. And I went to school at night, and I got my degree, and then I got a master's degree in it. And those degrees were in computer science. But I never had a job in computer science directly until I started doing the consulting stuff. And I always wanted one, but I never had one. I worked in manufacturing companies. So one day, manufacturing was dying in those years. I mean, the companies were just going out of business left and right, and foreign companies were taking over that kind of work because labor was cheaper. So there was just no future in manufacturing, but that's what I was doing. And one day I was at work. I worked for a company that made CDs, and it's a real interesting job. I mean, I enjoyed what I was doing, but I wasn't making any money. And Kevin and Tim were both out of high school, and Justin was in middle school. And I got a call from a friend of mine. He said, "Have you ever thought about being a consultant?" And I go, "What?" He said, "Yeah, have you ever thought about doing that kind of work?" And I go, "You know, what would it involve?" And he said, "You'd have to travel all the time, but it'd be pretty good money." And it turned out he had interviewed with a company in Athens, Alabama, that did that kind of work. They had consultants that they sent out to client companies. And he said, "They want to interview you." And or they asked him for people he could refer, you know, that he would recommend. And he called me and said, "Can I recommend you to them?" And I go, "Well, I don't have anything to lose to talk to them." And so he gave them my name, and I interviewed within a couple of days. And during the interview, they offered me a job sitting right there. I mean, I'd been 15 minutes in the interview, and they offered me a job. And the job was like three times what I was making already. I wasn't making anything already, so it's not like a huge amount of money, but it was more than what I was making, a lot more. And I talked about it with my wife at the time, Pam, and we thought, okay, it's a way to try something different, but it scared me real bad. I mean, it was a frightening thing. And so it's because of a reference from a man I knew that I didn't plan for anything like that, and it happened pretty quickly.
You know, Don, we've talked about that, and when we talked with Tony a couple of weeks ago, we talked about that a little bit, how good things just happen sometimes. And Tony was commenting, he was real strong about it too, Tony. I remember, you know, that whatever you're doing, you got to be ready for the opportunities. And that's the trick, is just to be prepared to take advantage of something. And apparently you were, you know, at that time, you're ready. And something just walked in the door, and there you were.
Yeah, you know, part of consulting is a lot of people that work in that industry as consultants are straight out of school. So they're like 24, 25. You know, they've never worked in industry at all before. And then they take the role where they're going to go into businesses and tell them, this is how you ought to do this or that. So there's a certain pushback because of a 40-year-old person's getting told how to do something by a 25-year-old that's never been anywhere. So when I went into consulting, I was 40, 45 or so. So when I was in a room with people, the client would always defer to me, almost always. And a big part of the reason is because I was just older than everybody else. You know, it's perception to a degree. But what I did was I help companies implement software. It's called application software, and it's software that people use to run a business, like to create purchase orders and create and write payroll checks and stuff. And that's what it, you know, it, so that's what I did. But a lot of times I'm talking with a client and they've got to trust you. And age was kind of a benefit for me because people deferred to older people. And I enjoyed that particular benefit up until really throughout my entire consulting career, because I was almost always the oldest consultant in the room, because most consultants start at 24, 25, and by the time they're 45 or so, they say, I don't want to travel anymore. And so they get out of it. So I started out as being the oldest, and I was the oldest on almost every project I ever worked on.
You know, Tony had asked a little earlier in his comments, and something we might want to follow up on, Don. You started out, was it Columbia? Or were you? Was that one of your first jobs there was it a coal mine or something there in Columbia?
Yeah. I've had a couple of international projects, but the one in Columbia wasn't my first. It was probably maybe the fourth or fifth project. So I'd been a consultant maybe for 5, 6, 7 years before I ever went to Columbia. And it's project to project. So you go from one company to the next company to the next company. And there's not a lot of continuity with the people that you work with. But, so when you finish one project, you talk to people at different companies about where you're going to go next. So I finished a project in Portland, Oregon. Great place. I love Portland. But I finished a project, and I was talking to someone on the phone because all these interviews are on the phone, and the guy was in Birmingham. And he said, I had responded to an ad that they had for consultants, and he said, would you be willing to travel? I go, yeah, I travel every week. He goes, no, I mean out of the country. And I go, well, yeah, as long as I'm at home most of the time. He said, yeah, we can do that. And he said, well, would you go to Colombia? And I go, Colombia, you know, like in South America? He goes, yeah. Aren't they in the midst of a war down there with rebels? He says, yeah, they are, but our place is pretty secure. And he said, if you do this, we'll fly you to Colombia on our private jet. Now, right away, that sounds pretty good. You know, it's like, I've never been on a private jet. And, we have described the facility and that we'd go to Cartagena, Colombia sometimes, and then we'd go to this coal mine. And I thought, yeah. And they offered really good income for it. And the company was Drummond Coal Company, headquartered in Birmingham, and I went to Colombia. I worked back and forth in Colombia for about a year, and it was a dangerous place, but I never really felt, you know, for me it was an adventure. Now, it's kind of foolhardy in a way, because I did have Justin was not out of school yet. So, you know, it's kind of selfish in a way that I went there, but you know, it's down the torpedoes full speed ahead is pretty much what I did.
Well, yeah, that's true. You know, I recall you telling us some stories about some of the accounts or some of the experiences that you had done. And some of them were not particularly pleasant and a little bit scary. Can you recall any of those that you could share with us?
I remember one. I remember a lot. There were a lot of those. I think I was only scared one time. And I worked in a coal mine and had a lot of Colombian nationals worked in this mine. Most of the workers were Colombians that didn't speak English. And, of course, I don't speak Spanish. So, and I worked in a place where they had mechanics working on these big, huge trucks. When the bed of the truck is open, it's 75 feet high. So these are not small trucks. But anyway, these guys are mechanics, and they wanted to petition the company for more income. they thought they were being mistreated, and they were. There were a lot of reasons they were being mistreated. And I felt I was on the side of these guys. I thought they deserved more money, and I thought they were being mistreated. And so they were marching around the facility, inside the facility. They couldn't strike. The government wouldn't allow it. But they could march around and chant and all of that stuff to try to get the company's attention. So one day I'm standing out there, you know, in the parking area, in dusty, dirty parking area, and these Colombian guys come marching by, and they're chanting something, and I was supportive of them, and I know I was smiling. And I also know I gave them the okay sign with my hand, where you touch your index finger to your thumb and hold your other fingers up, you know, the okay sign with your hand. And later on, I find out that that's an obscene sign in Colombia. What I was trying to say to them is I'm supportive of you guys. Now, they couldn't understand me, and I couldn't understand them, but I'm pretty much telling them it was one of those kiss my behind kind of signs, but I didn't know that's what that meant.
Yeah, look at dumbass American over there, yeah.
Yeah, and he's saying to us, he's saying kiss my behind, but, so it was insulting to these men, but I didn't know that. And there was never any kind of result. But later on, I realized that people get violent, and I could have put myself in real jeopardy because I just didn't know something. But, yeah, it was...
Yeah, and of course, a lot of places, you were talking, what, Don, about... and I always found this odd, too. You know, you must have been on 50 different jobs over the years all over the world. One of them sticks in my mind, Tony, is Trinidad. And, you know, and somebody would ask, well, you know, what's in Trinidad? And I said, well, I don't think much of anything. But apparently there's something there. And you told me about your experiences, Don, of going to Trinidad. Can you share that with us?
Well, I don't remember where I was working before going to Trinidad, but I talked to the people there, and they said, yeah, we have this project, and describe what it would be, and I would be a good fit. And if you come here, you can come to Trinidad and go home every week. Now, Trinidad is a most southern island, I guess, and it's sort of the southern edge of the Caribbean. It's just off the coast of Venezuela. You can see Venezuela from Trinidad, and but it's a pretty big country, but it's not a tourist country. They got an oil-based economy, but it's a violent country, which I had no idea that it was violent. I thought it would be like going to somewhere in the Bahamas, but it's not that. So I go to Trinidad, and I'm there for working for the Trinidad National Telephone System. And the hotel that I stayed in was about maybe a half a mile from the office I worked in. And they were real clear, don't ever walk to work or walk back to the hotel because it's dangerous. And I go, what? And they have a guard around the hotel parking lot and fence so that they check you before you come into the hotel parking lot. And they said, don't walk outside the fence, ever. And after I'd been there about a month, I found out there had been a random bombing in the street outside our office building. Somebody just left a bomb in a trash can, and it didn't kill anybody, but it made a couple people deaf because they were too close to the explosion. And I started asking the company, why didn't we hear about that? Why didn't I hear about that before coming down here? And I really pitched a fit. And I told them, I may not ever come back. I mean, this is just not right. And they say, what if we get you a bodyguard? Well, I go, how's a bodyguard going to stop a bomb? And so they did. They got me a bodyguard and my own car. And in the morning, I'd go down to the lobby of the hotel, and the bodyguard would be standing there, and he would drive me to work that half a mile, and he would stay in the parking garage inside a guarded fence area until I wanted to go to lunch. And then he'd drive me to lunch. And then when I got finished with that, if I wanted to, I'd go back, work in the afternoon, go to dinner somewhere. He'd drive me to dinner and stand outside waiting for me. And, I mean, you really felt you were treated well, but it was really a dangerous, dangerous place. And about the middle of that project, Dixie came down to Trinidad to spend a weekend to travel. And we drove all over Trinidad, but it is a violent place. There was one time when I first got there, I took a drive out to the end of the country along this road that had bars and stuff right up against the road. I was the only white guy that I saw for hours and hours. And this is really a poverty-stricken place. And, you know, I get this creepy feeling everybody's looking at me. And I drove maybe 30, 40 miles. And I turned around, I went back to the hotel, and the next morning I found out that there had been a execution of somebody in one of those bars along that road. Some sort of gang head. And immediately after he got executed, they activated the army. And that night, before the night was over, a leader of a rival gang was executed in public. They both got shot in the back of the head in a crowd that had no witnesses. And both of those happened, and I had no idea what was going on at all, but Colombia is a much safer place than Trinidad. I wouldn't go back to Trinidad no matter what, but, you know, I worked there for a while.
You know, that's always been an interesting story for me, Johnny. And of course, on the other end of all of that, I'm sure that there are some wonderful places. I know you spoke fondly of the friends that you made there in Australia when you worked there.
Yeah, I worked in Australia. I was undergoing divorce, and I was at a point where I needed something in life. I mean, I was just really falling apart pretty bad. And so that happened, and I go to Australia.
John, I remember that, Don. Go ahead.
Well, so I go to Australia, and I was in Sydney, and it was an adventure, and everything was new, and get to see a new country and all of that, and the work was fun. And I've gone back to Australia once since then. But yeah, I made a lot of friends. One thing that I do that in this work, since I work with people, and then at the end of some project, I leave. Let's say I worked there a year, and I've developed relationships with people. And when the project's over, I know I'm never going to see those people again, ever. You know, it's a hard thing to change that often. You know, like once a year, you completely go to completely new people, even though you enjoy the people you've been working with. And when I first started consulting, I wanted to do something to acknowledge that those people meant something to me. And usually at the end of a project, the people I work with will have a dinner or something, and we'll go out at night and enjoy dinner and maybe a couple of toast or something, and then that's it. And when I realized that was going to happen, I decided I wanted to recognize people I've been working with. So I made a certificate that I call a citizenship certificate for the state of Alabama. And what I would do is and it looks like a real formal certificate, my honorary citizenship. And I'd put people's names on this document, and I'd put the dates and all of that, and it's got some boilerplate in the middle. And then these dinner things, I wouldn't give it to everybody. It'd just be one or two people each one. And I'd say, first one I ever did, the guy's name is Gary Rialt. And I'd go, Gary, would you please stand up? And he don't know what the hell's going on. So he stands up, and I say, Gary, I have something real official. It's a serious thing. I want you to just concentrate. And you got to take a test. So he's thinking, what the hell are you doing? And I'd say, okay, what's the greatest country music band of all time? And they'd look at me, and everybody would look around, and what the hell is he doing? And I'd go, of course it's Alabama. And then I'd say, what? And it'd be different questions every time I did it with anybody. But
yeah.
I'd say, what great southern state joined the Union in 1819? And they'd look around, and I'd go, of course it's Alabama. And then every question and answer was Alabama. Because everybody knows that's where I'm from because of my accent. And we talk about that sometimes. So at the end of that, they start getting every question. You know, I could ask them anything. And what's the greatest football team?
That's a good way to end it up, Don. In fact, probably a good way to end up our conversation today, too. We're getting close to ending time here. And Tony, did you want to make any comments or anything before we call it a day here?
Yes, I had forgotten about Trinidad. I know he had spoken about that before. I'd heard the stories, but I had, for some reason, forgotten about Trinidad and how dangerous it was, because he'd told me stories before. We had discussed these before. And, I was thinking Colombia would be the most dangerous, but I remember now he spoke before about Trinidad. I'd totally forgotten all that.
All right, man. Well, it's been really, really interesting today, and I'm looking forward to being able to listen to this and once we get all the recording done. But it's been good, and we're going to try to do this again next week and maybe carry it forward with some other things of interest in your background and in your life. But I appreciate you, my brother, and it's been a good day. And Tony, thank you, man. Do you have anything you'd like to add here at the end, Don?
No, I am really pleased with what we're doing as far as our interviews for family and stuff. It's a satisfying thing, and I know we all share that. We have a kind of a responsibility, I think, to our descendants to do something like this, and so they'll know a little bit. They'll know about us, and they'll know what we sound like. And I think there's a lot of satisfaction in that.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much, Tony. If you don't have anything, I'm going to call it quits, and we will be done today.
All right, gentlemen. Sounds good to me.
Okay,
I stopped the recording. It was 37 minutes and let's see, still...